Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow. Rabbits multiplying. I was here all day and there were like 20 people and now there are so many. So, you know, we're in session. So there's some people here who've been sitting and walking and eating very quietly for a couple of days. And then there are some other people who may have been doing the same thing, but may have been doing something else the last couple days. So hopefully, if you've been in the session, you can let some of the energy of all these people that just arrived into your body, the embodied energy. Wow. And maybe if you're coming from outside the building, you can let the embodied stillness of the people in this retreat just begin to permeate you. So I'm going to focus my talk today on a couple of women, Chinese Zen nuns, Xingang and Yikui, and particularly Yikui, and some poems they wrote. And I'm just going to start by reciting you a poem by Xingang. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the universe assembles on the tip of a feather. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. So I've talked about this poem quite a few times. It's kind of like Xingang's greatest, you know, it's like her number one single. But today I'd just like to talk about a very particular thing, which is about fear and anxiety, protection. A teaching about protection is a teaching to support you when you experience fear and anxiety. And there's a particular kind of anxiety that nags away at people who practice meditation, I think many of them. Many of them very consciously, some of them unconsciously. And that is, shouldn't I be doing something? Shouldn't I be doing something more important? Is this enough? Shouldn't I be achieving something instead of just having my mind churn away? I came here to this retreat and I thought I would get calm. And yet, turns out, my mind is just doing what it does. Shouldn't I be accomplishing something, attaining something, acquiring something? Nagging anxiety that this meditation practice just is not a reasonable way to meet the world, because we're not doing something much and we're not making things happen. So it runs contrary to such a fundamental belief we have as human beings. We need to be doing things. The essayist and poet Audre Lorde wrote once, "Self-care is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare." So I'd like to just take an opportunity to touch with the heart, the context of this piece of writing, which is that Audre Lorde felt that as a woman of African descent in the United States, she was exposed to so much brutality that it was like being in a war, and that staying alive was something she really had to work at. Personally, though, I
generally don't use any metaphors about warfare and warriors. So I'm not up here trying to cultivate spiritual warriors. There are other people who do, and it's cool. But just given my makeup, it doesn't seem like that's a good idea. So I'll leave that to her. But yes, taking care of the self matters. And, you know, so I segued from talking about meditation to talking about self-care. So all the people in session at this point are feeling really confused because they're like, do we get massages later? Where's the hot tub? So self-care can include just doing things that feel really nice, that are nice for you. But self-care, when it comes to the meditative practices of our tradition, is a little bit more radical. When you have children, if you take care of them, you don't just give them what they want. I think we all know that. The practice of meditation is not a practice of giving us what we want, because we want to achieve something, attain something, acquire something, or get something. And this practice is one of non-achieving, non-attainment, non-gaining. But it's self-care. That's really radically taking care of the self. So, Shingon left us this lovely poem and many others. Shingon was a Linji Zen nun. I should clarify, Chan. So she's Chinese. Chan is the Chinese pronunciation of the word that's pronounced Zen in Japan. I'm thinking 17th century. And she was... The cool thing about 17th century China is there's really good historical records. They like record keeping in China at this time. So you can, like, a lot of the stories we tell about Zen teachers are probably mostly made up. But when it comes to someone like Shingon, you actually can claim some kind of, like, historical accuracy, which has some kind of value, I guess. Anyway, so she was a teacher who lost her, she was married. And her husband died when she was pretty young. I can't remember, either 24 or 32. And then she devoted her life to Chan practice and became a really popular teacher. So she was known throughout her region. A huge group of people came to train under her. She had about 9 Dharma heirs. And she was very active in her community, working with people outside of the convent to promote harmony and wellness in her area, and she was clearly, like, really, really beloved in the area where she lived. Beloved. So, one of her students, Yikui, also was married and had her husband die young. It was either at 24 or 32. So I remember, anyway... But anyway, after the death of her husband, she went to go and practice under the training of Shingon. And their relationship seems to have been very beautiful. Yikui has a number of really beautiful poems about her relationship with Shingon. And it just brings to mind the fact that these people, although Shingon was a teacher to many kinds of people and connected with people throughout her community, she had this deep bond with another person who had a very similar kind of suffering she'd experienced. And this is something to be aware of as needs that we have and other people have, is a need to be connected in healing practices with people who share our particular mode of suffering. So, you know, we see certainly like 12-step groups come to mind. But after the Vietnam War, there was a lot of realization that the people who were coming home, who were experiencing a lot of trauma, who had been in that war, really found a lot of healing by being together with other people who had shared that particular experience. Not just like going to see a therapist who would give them set techniques, but actually just be with people where they could be real with their pain. And we see other kind of affinity groups. Susan Nelson has been leading a women's retreat down at Hokkyoji every spring for years. That's a particular group of people that have a particular set of interests and sufferings that are distinct. And they get together, and I've heard wonderful things about that retreat. I think it, I don't know when the date is. It hasn't happened already, has it? Okay. So, and we're seeing proliferating around the United States now more and more people of color only meditation groups. So, yeah, this is just an important thing. So, Yikui, though, had this great relationship with her teacher. And then Shingon died. And Shingon, one of her other students, whose name escapes me, Ying Long, or something, anyway, became the abbess of her monastery, which, by the way, was called Crouching Lion Monastery. We've got to work on our branding, Tim. Crouching Lion. That's cool, man. Anyway, Yikui went off, actually, to practice somewhere else. She made a place called the Cloister of Investigating Commonality. And she's... You can see why the Crouching Dragon, or Crouching Lion place. Anyway, investigating commonality, intimacy. Really checking it out. So anyway, she began to attract a lot of followers there. And it was great. She writes all these poems about how, like, chill it is. Like, really, she just, like... I'm letting go of it all. And she's just talking about the clouds. And I'll read you one of these poems. It's like, wow. It's great. And, you know, I've read the historical record of, you know, she's talking about how great it was to just be in this little place with some followers. And it was great practice. And then her Dharma sister, who was Shingon's heir, died. And they said, oh, who's going to lead the big monastery? We need an abbess. Let's go get Yikui. And they go get Yikui. And in those days, you say, hi. Yes. Just like when the work leader gave me the bathroom cleaning assignment yesterday. Hi. All right. Good. Here we go. So she goes back, and she begins serving a much larger community. So having spent this time immersed in quiet retreat, self-cultivation, and self-care, at the moment of the call, she returns to the community. And then you have this record of her interacting with all these different kinds of people throughout the environs that she lived in. And you get the sense she didn't like it as much. This is actually very common in Zen literature, by the way. I'm sorry to say, a lot of Zen people are like, it was great till they made me be the abbot. Anyway, so, yeah, I don't hear that from Tim. I don't. Anyway, so, but there's some really funny stuff when you dig it. The person who translated these poems, Beata Grant, also wrote a book called Eminent Nuns, and it's based largely on the record of Yikui, Shingon, and some of their compatriots. And there's a lot of talk about they decided they have to build a memorial stupa for Shingon, because she's, like, awesome. And then it's, like, years of fighting about where to put it in the yard. Really. And it's, like, a big deal. And it's, like, super stressful for Yikui and everyone else. Oh, man. I tell you what. Just find a hut and run away. No, I don't think so. I think find a hut do some self-care and return. Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. So anyway, I'm going to read you this poem by Ikui. And this really, this certainly has the flavor of coming from the time when she was more immersed in retreat. It's called Chan Meditation. It's about five stanzas, so sit back. Enjoy. Chan Meditation. Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow, becomes a way of life. How wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It is truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. The red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination, as if it possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. This toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger, but when the mind flower suddenly opens, the world becomes spring. Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. A tiny boat in the moonlight stirs up foam flowers on the water. Blossoming water lilies send across their fragrance in the dark. Hearing, seeing, knowledge, and consciousness are all one Dharma. Now this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long. So there's a lot in there. I'm not going to talk about the whole poem. I'm just going to pull a few themes out of here, as I did yesterday. Yesterday I was just talking about pretty much like body, 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 the body. But today I'll talk about some other things. So in the opening, she makes some pretty provocative assertions, I think. Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. So there seems to be a relationship that she's talking about between an internal peace, clarity, or purity, and an external peace, clarity, or purity. And I wonder if this just speaks to the experience of some of the people here. Does it not seem like sometimes things look very fraught out there? And if you turn around in here, you see, oh yes, they also look very fraught in here. That is to say, in the body, in the way the mind is functioning, and in the way, mind by that, the thinky part. I want to clarify, mind is pretty big, so I'll just say the thinky part. The thinky part, the body, and the heart are working. Ah! And out there it looks like, ah! I've been there. And perhaps there are other times where you have experienced that things look much more clear. And in here, things seem much more still. So she seems to be speaking quite experientially. And she is pointing in the direction that a lot of Buddhist teachings do, which is to emphasize the internal process, self-care. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. Maybe you do. You know, people go, well, what, are you just going to meditate all the time? The people I know who talk about it are spending like 0.5% of their lives meditating. Like, really? Like, I hear this all the time. Are you just meditating all the time? No, I meditate more than almost anyone I know, and it's probably about 5% of my life. I would be really cool with hanging out with someone who meditated way too much and just see what that's like. Really? Now, that is not to say that one can't use meditation in a way to escape that is harmful. That happens. But I don't think we're anywhere near, as a human species, as a culture, even as a culture of just the people in this room, too much time and too much emphasis on internal transformation through the self-care process of not giving the self what it wants. That is to say, zazen. However, back to my thought that this seemed awfully provocative. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. Well, dang. I feel like a lot of people would disagree with that. I'm like, my mind's unattached to things. They're going to be like, not pure, right? So this kind of like starts to look a little bit solipsistic if you're familiar with the term. But solipsistic meaning like really focused on just the self. But what are things? What are things? In this tradition, I mean, if we dig into the philosophy, we don't talk about things outside of things as experienced, as cognized by you. By you. That is to say, we want to think about all these objects outside of ourselves, but Mahayana Buddhism wants us to realize that those objects are always made within our experience by the process of how we make stuff up. We're dreaming a life. Directing the attention back to the internal process. What does this brings to mind? The first time I saw Reb Anderson give a talk, he was the former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. He was giving a talk on the Heart Sutra, and he said something like, what does Avalokiteshvara free everyone from? Like, what in the Heart Sutra, what's happening? All Avalokiteshvara does is free people from her or his, Avalokiteshvara being non-gender binary, what Avalokiteshvara does is free people and things from preconceptions that Avalokiteshvara has. Shedding prejudice and opening up to connection so that the action that comes out of the energy of the bodhisattva's life is all motivated by connection, not motivated by preconception. So the purity is things become purified of our own garbage. Oh, garbage is kind of harsh. But lust, greed, and anger, which is what we mentioned in here, and delusion, the delusion of our separateness, that we've got it all figured out. This is what things are purified of. And she's talking about meditation. she's going to get up and do a life that's engaged with people, and there's going to be preconceptions. Right? Those will come back. You'll have to work with them. It's cool. But can you even have, like, a second where you put it down? Maybe you could have a weekend or an afternoon or just a moment hanging out with a frog. I remember one time I was sitting meditation under a tree over by Lake Harriet, and a frog came and sat in my hand. Well, it sat... I must have moved it to my hand, but it was sitting on my like on my leg, and I was just like, hey. And then we just sat there. And I was like, I have no idea what's happening. And I'm pretty sure the frog didn't have it figured out either. So you're thinking, how do I get some of this not getting stuff? I want to know. Where is this? Oh, yeah. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of a pine tree. Oh, that's probably why I thought of that time sitting under that tree with the froggy. In moments of leisure. So, sitting under a pine tree. Well, Buddha sat under a tree. And actually, there's lots of Pali Canon Sutras where when Buddha gets really, he's like, come on, everybody, you can do it. He'll get like, you can feel the energy of his exhortation. And he'll be like, he says, here are the roots of trees. Here are the empty huts. Go and practice. Just go sit down somewhere quiet and do the self-care of not giving the self what it wants. Moments of leisure. In moments of leisure, does that mean she's just like, well, I got some time off. I'll go sit under a tree. Well, that's cool. I mean, everybody here's probably, a lot of people got jobs, got volunteer responsibilities, got human beings to take care of. So you could have, my moment of leisure is going to be go sit under a tree. This, it can be leisurely, really. What's Dogen Zenji say in the Universal Instruction for Zazen? The Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. It is the Dharma gate of joyful ease and repose. This is when people in the session start throwing things at me. But, you know, the thing is, the degree to which the way we talk and think about things forms them in our experience is, I think, unknowably vast. So it's really tricky when you sit in this chair and you're trying to, all you're trying to do is help people have enough energy to come and do their practice, right? And it's like, well, if you say, it's cool if you feel terrible, really, it's all right, that's normal, which is true, then people come to you and they go, I don't feel terrible at all, I must be doing it wrong. You're laughing, but it happens quite frequently. And then you go, oh, it's the Dharma gate of joyful ease and repose. And then they all come up and you're like, I'm really, oh, what can we do? We have to walk this balance of realizing. But don't forget that this practice can be one of joyful ease and repose, because what you're putting down is having to attain, get, or accomplish, or do something. And you will meet that nagging anxiety that it's not enough, that there has to be something else outside of this moment. You can just come back. Oh, hello. Breathing. Sounds. Sights. Thoughts. Look at those. They keep going. My thoughts all seem like they're over here. It's like I'm right-handed. I wonder if that's why. Anyway. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. Dang toad again. Toad in the moon? Everyone knows there's a man in the moon. Does anyone ever wonder, why isn't it a woman? Actually, often in Chinese, it's a rabbit. But they also have a toad. But here's the thing. As you look up at the moon, and you go, oh, I see the man there. And someone else looks up at it and sees, oh, I see the toad there. The way we see is powerfully, almost incomprehensibly culturally conditioned. It's a big deal. And one of the things that is really good to do is not zazen, but actually just going and hanging out with people who are from a very different culture than yours, or even just a little bit different. And just listening and experiencing their bodies and let it permeate who you are. You know, I've been involved in this group that's working on building an interfaith network. And they like had this vision statement. And I kept talking about it, and I realized that it had all these things about like getting better at doing things and helping each other be better at doing things. And we were all talking around how we're like, we thought we wanted to come here just to hang out together. People want to do this interfaith work because they want to be together, because they feel like maybe they will understand people better and be better to the people around them. Non-doing. I'm terrible at this. I've gotten in trouble. I'll go to people, I'll be like, hey, I don't want to, you know, be disrespectful of your time, so can we have a meeting and talk about doing a thing? And people will be like, I don't even know you. I'm like, oh, sorry. I just wanted to respect you. And it turns out the way I did it was really disrespectful from how you see things. Culture is different. There's a toad in the moon. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is confused by things. The flowers falling is interesting. It's hard to know whether there's supposed to be like a dual meaning to this, but generally speaking, that image is like very positive. It's like you're in heaven where it rains flowers. There's a bunch of Buddhist texts where it's like you go to heaven and it's like raining flowers. Sounds pretty good, I think. So it's a little different than Dogen's flowers fall. Maybe. Anyway, I'm going to talk to it just from the positive side. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. Well, again, making provocative statements. That Yihui, she's a provocative lady. I actually, personally, you know, I think debate can be useful. It's cool. It's cool, but what's she talking about here? What's freely speaking that makes, that allows heavenly flowers to fall versus debate that makes us only confused? This makes me think of, you know, most of my training here in understanding Dharma, which when I first came to it was like, this stuff is really weird. I mean, yeah. I would sit up and do morning study group on Thursday mornings for years and years and years. And, you know, sometimes it would be like, we would be talking about something and it was like connection and
you know, ideas were flowing between people, and I felt like I was able to get understand things about the text we were studying that had been completely impenetrable. It's great. And other times it was like, I'd be like just trying to tell someone about how they were wrong, or like make sure they understood the right way to view it. And that second one was much more confusing. Uh-oh, I broke it. So, I'm going to talk a little louder for a minute. Do you think that, did you just turn it down or off?
No.
Okay, great. Cool. Can you hear me? So, you know, we just do this. And probably everyone here knows when it's like a conversation feels like it's flowing, it's somehow promoting something, moving forward, and other times they feel very stuck. So, you know, this is Buddhism, so as it says in the Dhammapada, do not give your attention to what others do or fail to do. Give your attention to what you do or fail to do. Radically, we can always turn back to the ground of our agency and our power to do something beneficial. So the thing is, I really can't make other people talk about things in a way that I like. But what I can do is investigate the modes of speech that I think promote this harmony and connection rather than confusion. And at the bottom, you know, in nonviolent communication theory, we say, are you trying to connect or are you trying to control? One of the simplest formulas you can apply to just check in with what you're doing when you're speaking. Are you trying to connect or are you trying to control? It's still pretty good for practice, too. It's almost like trying to get, acquire, attain, or control things has some limitations. But just trying to be, which is when you just be, connection is there. It's there. The Dhammapada also says, victory begets enmity. The defeated dwell in pain. Happily, the peaceful live, discarding both victory and defeat. Dr. King once said, there is no such thing as defeat in nonviolence. That's Hugo Chavez. Sorry. Dr. King said, the unusual thing about nonviolence is that nobody is defeated. Everybody shares in the victory. So, things fall into debate, as you may have noticed. We noticed the world has fallen into debate, but how can I personally make the conversations I have be more about a collaboration? Or not so much how can I make them, how can I view them? Realize I'm involved in making something with somebody. Even if what's being made isn't getting the outcome that I want, can I be focused on making something beneficial with that person? Kikui talks about how fortunate and rare her opportunity seems. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible. I don't know exactly what she's about here, but it really reminds me of when Dogen arrived in China, and one of the first people he met, and one of the people who is one is just a huge inspiration, is this Tenzo, this cook. And he talked to the cook, and the cook was just like, yeah, I just cook with my whole heart. And Dogen was like, wow, blown away. And when they're parting, he says, Dogen, in his record, Dogen's little diary thing, he says, I said to him, is this not a fortunate karmic occurrence that we have met here? What does that mean? What's karma? Let's just keep it simple. It means like the world is big. It's so much stuff happening, and yet in this moment, you're here having this experience, and every once in a while you'll meet someone you feel connected with. Cherish it. Realize the beauty of that.
Yikwe then makes a bunch of statements about connection. First, he's talking about freely speaking of Dharma and not debating. It's cool. She doesn't mention an interlocutor. There's nobody else there, but is there? There's not an other, but there's a conversation. And she says, how wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It's truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. Back to this preciousness of connection. And yet, she doesn't talk about some person outside. We don't know who the person is. But there's a conversation and a connection just happening. Kind of like when I was talking yesterday, for those of you who are here, where did she end up on that shore at the end? What is this? How do we end up here? But she finds a kindred soul. Find a kindred soul, it matters. One of the most beloved sutras in the Pali Canon is where Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant for his whole life, or for his teaching career. And there's lots and lots of sutras about Ananda taking care of him, protecting him, remembering what he said. And they have some conversations. Well, one day Ananda goes to the Buddha and he says, "Oh, and Buddha, I think that maybe good friendship is half this path." And the Buddha says, "Not so, Ananda. Good friendship is the whole path. Good friendship is the whole path." But it really is kind of peculiar in this poem, because she says, how wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It's truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. The red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination, as if it possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. Is she just communing with her wood stove? And I wouldn't have a problem with that, because I've done it. I read this poem and I thought, I know this. I have really good friends. I have been supported by such good friends in this community and outside, and I feel profoundly fortunate. And I've tried to move towards that, to learn to be a good friend. But this kinship that can come when we stop instrumentalizing our experience, when we can just, instead of trying to do, get, attain, acquire, control, just meet, and not even meet because we're all already whole. This can happen with a person, but this can happen with yourself. Self-care, being intimate with the self. It can happen with a wood stove. I have had so many wonderful communal practices in this place, meetings with teachers, but I did a solo retreat at Hokyoji, and my best friend was Carl Holtman and the wood stove. Because Carl would just come and do work practice with me, and we'd go cut down some trees that needed to come down. And that was beautiful. And Carl is a dear friend. But the rest of the day, I was alone. I'd be in the zendo, and then I'd take a little break, and I'd go down, and I'd just sit and look at the wood stove. And it would just look at me. And it was good. It was whole. I wasn't waiting for it to be something else, at least some of the time. And that time I spent does change how things are. I am very grateful to have so many good friends here in this room. And I thank you all for listening. I think we can do. I can't remember if we usually have talking during session, but let's just do it anyway. So if anyone would like to ask a question or make an assertion, you're welcome to do so.
Your moment with the frog, there was a cartoon that went around on the internet that I think that some of you might have seen. A cartoon of your comment about the frog reminded me of. There's a man sitting by a lake, and he's sitting with his dog, and they're looking at the lake. It has a thought bubble for the man and the dog. The man is thinking about his car, his house, his mortgage, his jobs, all these things going on. Then there's the thought bubble of the dog. And the dog's thought bubble is the scene of the man and the dog sitting together looking at the lake. That's all the dog is thinking about.
Very nice. Very nice. Good friends. Arf. Arf. I hate to do it. If you could speak up so it can hear you in there, it's kind.
So we were talking about not a feminine form in the voice or something, but the Mayan tradition has Ixchel, who's a goddess of fertility, and she is in the voice. You can actually see her headdress and the snake wrapping around her in her position. So if you're in Central America, you see things everywhere. So she is actually in the moon.
Cool. There's a goddess in the moon. Fertility goddess. Well, maybe you guys are like getting into this whole quiet practice thing. Mm-hmm. Cool. Cool. Well, we can be quiet. That's good. That's good. So I'll turn it over to Pete. Thanks.